Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Ollie Mould, who's a lecturer in human geography at Royal Holloway at the University of London, about his new book, Against Creativity, which is published by Verso in 2018. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, hello.
We really need this book right now, as, you know, the kind of the march of creative industries, of transforming our places, giving us apparently new jobs, you know, sort of gathers pace. In some ways, many of these things seem to be kind of settled 10 years ago, and yet, you know, they still sort of zombie-like stagger on. And the book, I think, is a, you know, perfectly timed kind of intervention on this. And I guess it's something that, in some ways, we almost don't need to put into context, but it would be good to start with I guess, the question of where the book has come from and to what extent it's, you know, something that you've been working on for a long time, or it's something that you felt was just needed kind of right now.
Yeah, I mean, the former, I think. As you know, I've been involved in the policy realm and the academic realm, I guess, for, just a decade or so. And over that decade, it's become increasingly obvious that the term creativity has, you know, lost a lot of its power, a lot of what it actually means to, you know, create something from nothing. And it's been used by governments and businesses and teachers and all sorts of different institutions for their own gain, to grow them in a particular way, devoid of any sense of, you know, social justice or trying to iron out problems or just anything that goes against that mantra of, you know, more growth, be that economic growth, be that business growth, growth of, you know, your own self-worth or whatever it might be. So, yeah, it's one of these terms which has lost any validity, any meaning, and it's become very vacuous. And just more than that, really, it's been, I mean, weaponized is perhaps too strong, but it's been used as a veneer as to mobilize a whole set of, I guess, neoliberal practices, which are essentially creating more of the same problems, you know, precarity, injustice, and even, you know, the climate problems as well. So, it's about time, I think, that we radically redefine what it means to be creative, and that's really what the book is trying to do.
The book, it doesn't really start with a sort of, you know, old school, the Oxford English Dictionary defines creativity as, but rather it tries to give us a sense, a definition of creativity that's about power and about, you know, kind of power relationships, particularly actually in the context of contemporary capitalism. So it'd be nice to kind of get a sense of, I suppose, how you pin down creativity in this context of capital and power.
Yeah, so the lineage in the book is one that I tried to get at the political articulation of creativity. Now, you know, I deliberately didn't steer into the artistic world of art history and everything else, because it's that would have been a very different argument. So for me, the idea of creativity is one that you can trace in terms of creating new modes of living, new societies, new mindsets. To me, that is a inherently political act, because it requires changing the way people think. So I've really try to look back at the ways in which creativity has been thought in those particular ways, you know, going right the way back to, you know, the deities of the ancient world and how they, you know, just brought the world into being by sort of thinking it, right the way through to the commons and the diggers and the levelers, and thinking about how we can create a new common wealth by acting together, right the way through to, you know, the ways in which the modern interpretations of creativity have been thought about in terms of, like I said, economic growth and thinking about how all means of production now can be thought to be creative because they are inherently, you know, weightless or not emanating from a deindustrialized world or the new knowledge economy that sort of came about in the 80s and the 90s. So really this version of creativity has been commandeered by a capitalist narrative really to direct everybody's working life, their, you know, their home life, their, how they play, how they interact, to saying, well, look, how can you do that in order to create more stuff? How can you do that to create new things, new ideas, new ways of operating that can feed the market, that can be translated into economic growth? Because that's what we need to do. We need to grow the world. We need to grow our financial lives. And we can only do that by all, you know, all being creative. But as, you know, as the book details, that is a very, very prescribed, very particular view of creativity, and one that is, you know, about the individual, about the lack of any kind of collective thinking, one that is very about, you know, the privatization of the creative mindset.
And it also has, you know, quite obvious negative consequences. I mean, you know, we're recording this just after another major new report on climate change and the kind of, you know, limits of growth. But this, you know, sort of plays out on an individual level as well. And one of the things that the book tackles quite early on is the, I guess, the sort of distance between the promise of being creative, you know, you mentioned, you know, bringing new worlds into being, and actually the reality of the slog of sort of being a creative worker, being precarious. And you sort of contrast that, you know, precarity with a maybe a more idealized true vision of creative work, and that contrast struck me as being something that was a really sort of interesting frame to hear more about.
Yeah, so it's funny because in other discussions I've had with this, people have been arguing, oh well, you know, why are artists not creative? If you're working in the computer games industry, why, you know, why is that not creative? You know, I know plenty of people in these industries. And yet they are incredibly creative people. I'm not denying that. What I'm trying to argue is that their skills are being directed towards creating more of the same capitalist problems that we see. So, you know, just by simply sort of engaging in the, you know, the wage labor process, or engaging in creating a new computer game, which, you know, is fulfilling a gap in the market, that they're feeding this system. And the work, you know, the mantra of creative work is really completely sold in that way. So, you know, it's actually riffs on Thatcher's enterprising self, you know, this idea that we can all just release our inner creative entrepreneur and, you know, the economy and society will do wonderful things if we all just sort of look into ourselves and find that really great idea and put it down on paper, or put it to song, or put it on a computer code, and everything will be brilliant. You can sell it and become a billionaire. Now, this is, you know, that's fine for some people, but these are still creative people. So what the arguments I'd make is, well, what would happen if we didn't have those things kind of shoved through the wage labor or the market? You know, if we had sculptors and computer game people and you know, artists and academics all creating something outside of that system, what would it look like? A commons, or a more just way of consuming these things, you know, things that are far more democratically organized, perhaps. These better things, better ways of organizing society, at least in my view, can come about through the creative work of all these different people. But as it is currently, you know, dictated to, the energies of these people, the creative energies of these people, are just being kind of funneled into creating more of the same. So that's what I'm making the distinction. Let's see if we, you know, ask the question, what if we funneled those energies into creating something which is far more equitable? And that's really what I was trying to get at in that particular chapter.
Yeah, along with this really interesting idea that this term I quite liked, well, liked is probably not the right word, but this kind of idea about antisocial creativity. And quite unusually, actually, you draw on some examples from public service provision. You know, you mentioned there, you know, kind of artists, computer games, etc., as being what we think of as, I guess, the kind of normal creative work. But it was really interesting to have an example of healthcare and health service provision as a kind of warning about antisocial creativity.
Yeah, that's right. It's one of the mantras that you always hear about creative work is, I mean, particularly going to, you know, the writings of people like Richard Florida and others, it's that creative people are very passionate about their work and they work outside of their normal working hours and they, you know, they stay in the office till really late at night if they have a really great idea, or, you know, they might work at the weekends, or they're looking around the city for inspiration to feed into their next project. And it struck me as, you know, seeing the work of nurses and firemen and women and police officers, and just looking at the thing, well, these people are doing exactly the same sort of thing, that they are working extended hours, they are passionate about what they are doing, and they are creating, well, their work is going towards creating essentially a public good, a public sort of realm that is consumed without that, or at least in terms of the NHS, without that sort of marketized logic, although, you know, the arguments are that the NHS have become increasingly marketized in that way. But not notwithstanding, you know, to me, public services are doing exactly the same emotional work as these creative people. You know, they are invested in a view of life which they believe to be, you know, just and radical and everything else in terms of this, you know, the public consumption. And, you know, the last 12 months, when I was writing the book, you know, Grenfell happened and there was various scandals around the NHS. And I mean, Grenfell in particular, you looked at the images of these firemen and women just kind of slouched on the grass, just within, you know, clearly they've been working, in inverted commas, you know, for the last 24 hours straight, whatever it is. And they were just exhausted. And they just, you know, everyone was like, oh, wow, look at all these heroes. Look at these amazing people. And then what happens? They get, you know, they get refused a 1% pay rise or whatever it is. And it's just that the narratives just didn't fit. So why is it that we're calling these people, as in, you know, the kind of creative class, why are we calling them creative and not these other people who are doing exactly the same kinds of work, but they're trying to create an entirely different, well, not entirely different, but a public way of life, which is slowly being eroded.
This comes up as well, I guess, as a series of sort of critical oppositions or critical alternatives that come through the book. And, you know, we've been talking about healthcare provision, but in the second chapter, you sort of expand on that to not just think about, you know, what kind of work we should think of as creative, but what sort of bodies we should be thinking of as creative, and in some ways, you know, being allowed or not allowed to be creative. And this has come up a bit in the literature already about, you know, the need to be kind of like young and, you know, sort of capable of long hours, etc. But you draw on, I think, a set of literature, a set of themes that has really been marginalized or perhaps missed actually in discussions of creative work, which is around questions of differently abled or disabled bodies. And it was a kind of fascinating take actually around both the sort of barriers to being creative, but the kinds of creativity that foregrounding these kinds of bodies opens up.
Yes, it's an interesting one. It's, you know, deeply personal to me and my family, but I think that there's a great deal of utility, social utility, to be gained by connecting with disabled people in far more empathetic ways. And, you know, these people are experiencing worlds, be that through, you know, the different wirings of their senses or the way that their brains work. You know, in the book, I talk about synesthesia and deafness and blindness, and the kinds of worlds that these people are experiencing are kind of very different to the ones in which, you know, in inverted commas, normal people kind of experience. And I think that that's creative. That is a world which is on the margins, but it's a different kind of world, and a world which, you know, because of the nature of the injustices and the marginalization that disabled people experience, worlds that are very much outside of the norm or the center, but they're worlds in which contain a great deal of solutions to the contemporary problems. So, you know, I talk about the blind architect, Chris Downey, and you know, he asked a very poignant question: what would it be like if we designed cities with the blind in mind? And he sort of says, you know, they'd be more walkable. They'd be, you know, you'd encourage more interaction. Pavements would be wider. You know, no cars. And these are exactly the kinds of cities that people are yearning for, but people don't really know how to do it properly. So why don't we speak to these people? Why don't we engage with these people to sort of say, okay, great. Well, how do we do that? There are other examples. Sorry, there's one more. There's another example in, I didn't write about in the book, primarily because I saw it afterwards, but there's a group of, there's a university in the States, and they have an entirely deaf campus, and they design their buildings so that, you know, for example, there are no stairs anywhere, so people don't have to look at their feet, so they can look at each other when they're signing, because, you know, to sign, you need to see what the other person's doing. They have very large rooms, so you can stand at either end and sign. So, you know, this is couched in this rhetoric of, well, let's, of language, like, well, why do we call it hearing loss? Why don't we call it deaf gain? So, yeah, for me, these disabled bodies are part of worlds which I think offer not all, but some solutions to the current problems we see.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, they're sort of set against the backdrop of worlds that are, I guess, increasingly kind of unsupportive or hostile. You talk in the book quite a lot about austerity and the kind of creative nature of austerity that remakes the public sector, you know, that kind of remakes the relationship between individuals and capital. And it struck me as a kind of accelerating process almost, that, you know, normally we'd be thinking of as kind of, you know, creativity is something that would solve problems, but actually, you know, with austerity, it's an idea that really kind of presents even more problems for people's day-to-day life and their kind of everyday experience of both, you know, work and the public realm.
Yeah, it was, I mean, creativity and austerity, I think, are the lines somewhere, they go hand in glove. And I think that it was interesting because I situated it around David Cameron when he talked about the big society. And when I heard that back in 2010, was it, or 2012? And it very much was like, well, great, you know, let's have all this community stuff. Let's have all this community engagement, and let's get neighborhoods, you know, doing the Meals on Wheels, or let's get school children into sort of really enliven the library setting. But it was like, well, what you're doing is you're just taking away, that gives you an excuse to retract those public services and therefore, you know, feed into that mantra of the small state, which is very much, you know, the way in which capitalist state seem to be going. So it was a veneer of, you know, community focused creativity, but really what it was all it was doing was just putting a sort of a sheen on what was essentially, you know, decreasing public services and you know, austerity. So to me, they're in trying to encourage creativity, but what they're really doing is just saying, well, look, all the energies that you have that would have been directed towards, you know, enjoying yourself, having a leisure life, or, you know, in leisure time, and having a good time outside of work, you now have to redirect that energy into making sure that your neighbours, or who are perhaps infirm or whatever, have their meals, or you're making sure that your elderly relative who's had their carer taken away, who, you know, your elderly relative might have dementia and their carer has had lost their job through austerity, you now have to be the person that looks after them. But it's okay, you can call themselves a dementia carer day or something. And that to me is very, very problematic, because it's just not allowing sort of society's lives to flourish outside of that capitalist system. So austerity for me is it's been mobilized using this kind of creativity language there or thereabouts. But it's just creating more of the same problems.
Yeah, it was really interesting because, as I say, usually that moment would be, you know, a series of inspiring alternatives through creativity. But you're, you know, you sort of suggest we should be very cautious actually about this. And it comes up much later on in the book as well. And I think we'll leave aside the kind of discussion of tech maybe till the end of the podcast. But I think there's a line through this that connects up this idea about a creative city and the idea of art washing particular places as well, where, you know, we think of creative cities as, oh, that's great. You know, everywhere should be creative. You know, our cities should be, you know, kind of spaces for creativity. But actually, much as with, you know, the kind of creative power of austerity to destroy the public realm, similarly, you tell a story about the creative city being something we should be really cautious about.
Yes. I mean, as a geographer, and, you know, it's the spatial manifestation of the creative rhetoric is, you know, to me, actually, obviously most obvious in the urban environment. And it's been going on since the creative city was coined, I guess, back in 1995. And art washing has become this term which has been banded around, the history of which, you know, stems to some of the sponsorship of some of London's or the UK's cultural institutions by oil companies. So the BP, for example, sponsoring the Tate. And people were, particularly environmental lobbyists, were saying, well, look, you're using your sponsorship of the Tate to, you know, soften your hard image of a polluting company. And it was called art washing. It was this idea that, you know, you're painting this sort of, you know, nice, fluffy, socially engaged ideal on the face of what is essentially still kind of planet destroying oil refining corporations. And that term has been utilized now to talk about the creative city of the last few years, which sees, in the UK at least, local councils, particularly in London, combining with or cozying up with developers who, of course, have the financial clout to build new housing estates, new retail parks and everything else, because councils don't have the money because of austerity, obviously. So, and what they do is they use artistic practices and creative people, in inverted commas again, to sell the place or to give it a veneer of kitsch, cool, creative, bohemian living. All the while, two things are happening. First of all, those artists themselves are being exploited. You know, they're kind of getting pushed out of the places that they've been given free space for or very cheap rent for. And secondly, the local residents are being displaced, and they're just, you know, these places are being redeveloped and or completely destroyed. So a new sort of professional class can move in. It's essentially a sort of the manifestation, or the most recent manifestation of a gentrifying process, which, you know, has been going on for donkey's years. So it's this new veneer. It's that idea that it's just been used as a veneer just to kind of carry on the same processes. Give it a new kind of 21st century spin with hipsters and you know, artisan coffee shops and all this sort of stuff, but it's just the same stuff happening over and over again. So, yes, it's been used, this term art washing has been used. And so it's interesting because the creative city idea, you don't really hear that term much anymore in policy realms, but it's kind of bled through into everything that's done now. The smart city is the new kind of thing that people are trying to enact. But even within that, you've got this idea of creative tech and everything kind of saying, well, you know, it's the whole thing is designed to encourage creativity, and the whole city, like you say, just has to be creative. And it's almost taken for granted. It's the new urban ante that you have to be creative. That's just a given, along the particular lines that they want you to. So yeah, art washing is this term which has really been used to flag this quite really, really problematic process. And it's not just artists. You know, you've got, there are I cite some of the Heather McLean's work, sort of saying, you know, it's feminist communities, they're being co-opted in the same kind of way. And it's problematic. It's a real problem. And cities are being hollowed out because of it.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned tech, because that it is, you know, the kind of final, I suppose, area of ambivalence or caution, because, you know, a lot of this stuff is bound up with the new tech economy. How we think about the creative industries is, you know, inseparable in some ways from sharing economies and new modes of kind of tech. And there's always this kind of idea that somehow tech will sort of solve these questions and will kind of save us, and, you know, new forms of sharing are delivering, you know, cheaper goods, or, you know, making kind of cities more functional stuff. But actually, you know, there are really serious questions about the extent to which tech is doing the job of capitalism in terms of, you know, creating new markets for more types of exploitation and more, you know, kind of problematic practices, even as it's presented as kind of neutral, dispassionate, you know, it's just the algorithm, you know, it's not human bias, etc. And that was really interesting in terms of the kind of antidote to celebrations of tech as being something that will save us.
Yes, I mean, I suppose the thing to say is I'm not new to this body of literature. There's been some really fantastic work. I mean, Zeynep Tufekci's work in the States, I think, has been the forerunner of this. And I quote some of her stuff. But no, you're right, and it's this neutrality of tech which I think is being, which is banded about, is, oh, you know, these algorithms, they're unbiased, and, you know, they can, you know, neutrally sort out the world in a very fair and kind of autonomous, you know, in brackets, and therefore neoliberal kind of way. But they don't have this, you know, this is just, it's rubbish, you know. There's this neutrality is just not there. The biases are embedded in the system that created it. And it's funny you mentioned that, you know, Silicon Valley has always been the go-to. I mean, back in when the creative industries were first coined, back in New Labour's day, it was all done via task force that was sent over to the States, you know, to Silicon Valley and to Hollywood, to sort of say, well, you were making loads of money through IP. How do we replicate that in a UK context? So it was there at the very beginning of the creative industries, and it's, you know, it's right here now. So but yeah, these, what gets me, and funnily enough, when I was writing the chapter, Blade Runner 2049, you know, 2049 came out, and I went to go and see that at the cinema, and it was just one of the most depressing times. I was writing about all this tech and taking over the world and everything. It was really quite harrowing to write it. But what I was witnessing, and when I was researching this stuff, it's like, well, all these algorithms, they're being presented as neutral, but what they're doing is they're infecting our own behavior, and we are becoming algorithmic. And, you know, I don't know about you, but when you check your phone, it's like, well, I check this first and then this first and then this first, you know. And it's infesting the way that we operate, and I don't think that we're wired to be that way. It's causing mental health problems, it's causing loneliness and all these things we hear about in the news. And what I think Silicon Valley does is it offers us the world, to plug in. It says plug in and the world will be better, but it doesn't let us plug out. And I think that we need to create tech systems, which I'm not denying are, you know, have their utility and have their place, and they are, you know, fantastic at creating new kind of democratic systems and allowing people with disabilities to connect with other people and all sorts of things. They have their social utility, but they don't have the ability to plug out. You know, what we should be creating systems that allow us to plug out as easily as you can plug in, or to, you know, to reverse to the real world, if you like, in inverted commas, as easy as we can kind of plug into this virtual world. And I think that's not happening. And so for me, the tech industry and the sharing economy is eroding our ability to be human. And I think it's kind of just, you know, like I say in the book, it's sort of making what it means to be human just another line of code, which is obviously incredibly problematic.
I mean, the book ends with a sort of optimistic and kind of hopeful note, you know, sort of brings JFK into dialogue with Alice in Wonderland, you know, and kind of like sets the task of sort of believing in impossible worlds. And it'd be interesting to sort of hear, I guess, the kind of the sense of how you think we can do that, and, you know, how that more productive and world-creating kind of creativity can be foregrounded against the sort of mundane or antisocial creativity that that we have now?
I mean, I think it boils down to the question, what is it that we want to create? I mean, creativity for me is about, you know, creating something that propels us to better and more just worlds that just currently do not yet exist. And so I'm taking my line here from Henri Lefebvre, who was that sort of famous French philosopher who talked about all sorts of things. But so, yeah, so the question for me is, what is it that we want to create? And I don't think that question is being asked in the creativity discourse that we are currently, you know, bombarded with. So if we want to create more of the same problems that capitalism has put us in, and, you know, with the report that you mentioned that came out the other day, you know, it gives us 12 years before we have an end of an ad. That, to me, that just doesn't seem like a viable option anymore, you know. So what is it that we want to create? And the answer to that question is very, very important. So if we want to create a common world, a world in common that we can, where, you know, people are far more equal, is a fairer, more just society, which, you know, we all want to be pushing towards, then we need to start thinking creatively about how we create those worlds. We need to think about how we can start wrenching away really talented and creative people away from this market-driven capitalist discourse into creating systems which are sustainable, which are environmentally sound, and, you know, are, don't replicate gentrifying, precarious, enabling systems. So, you know, engineering, for example, climate engineering, you know, these are some of the most creative ideas out there. I was looking at one the other day about these places in Canada that suck CO2 out of the air and create a new fuel that is kind of carbon neutral. But it's just, you know, these are fantastic creative ideas and creative processes. How could we take that and put it in the hands of the people? How can we take that and put it and make it a more commonly available technology, and how can we ensure that it maintains its democratic involvement? Now, yeah, those are the questions which I think are really important as we go forward as we charge towards this sort of climate catastrophe which we seem to be heading towards. So, yeah, what is it that we want to create? And for me, the answer to that is a world that doesn't have capitalism as its driving force, a more common world in which everybody has the opportunity to live a sustainable and fulfilling life.
And is that the kind of thing you're going to be writing about next? Or, I mean, to an extent, this is your sort of second book around kind of questions of creativity. And is it, have you had quite enough about being creative about creativity, or?
I don't know. I think, well, funnily enough, the next book is in progress. I think I mentioned it before, and I kind of took a hiatus from it to write this book. I think it was kind of, you can think about these things in trilogies, I guess. But this seemed to be like a sort of the important book that needed to be written in order to foreground this next book, which is about the seven ethics. You know, the seven ethics of the commons. And, you know, I think there are some really important mindsets that we can enact, that certain types of resources which we can all benefit from, which allow us to realize these, you know, impossible worlds. You know, I won't go into detail, but because they're fairly kind of rooted in theoretical ideas, but, you know, things like being collective, you know, being empathetic, even things like, you know, thinking about love radically, you know, these are the sorts of things which we're going to need to think about and enact in order to create this new anti-capitalist or post-capitalist more just world. So yeah, it's on the horizon. It's something which I'm trying to write next, and we'll see where that goes.